Okay, shall we begin? So last time, if you'll recall, we were talking about this notion of humanism, and I mentioned that there would be two lectures on this idea of humanism. Humanism I defined as a doctrine that's centered on human beings, something folks came up with in the Renaissance, where human beings stopped thinking of themselves as cowering beasts among other beasts on the world, but started thinking of themselves as, well, you know, we could kind of take control here and maybe make a better place for our inhabitation. So it's centered on the notion that human beings are sort of the supreme beings on earth, and that they are they have a capacity for self-realization through reason. That they actually can figure things out and make themselves better, more fulfilled, more empowered by reason. And so last time we looked at this notion as applied to everything from doorknobs and chairs and furniture, how it can actually provide comfort, how it can provide a kind of intellectual satisfaction of this is done in a very straightforward, a very simple way. It's using, common materials. It's assembling them logically, and it can provide comfort and fulfillment of what we need. It also can reflect very much our physiognomy. Certainly, if it's humanism, it's got to work with the human body. And then we expanded that to the scale of, say, buildings like Paimyo Sanatorium, where pretty much every decision, all the way through, wow, is this responding to the psychology of a patient? Someone's got tuberculosis. They're going to be isolated from their family and from their friends. What is that like? What is their respiratory ailment like? What is the treatment of that? What kinds of things do they need? What is comfort if you're lying flat on your back all the time and you can't walk around? What's the difference in a horizontal person and a vertical person? You know, how do your limbs behave differently? How does your body in terms of temperature behave differently if you're flat on your back? How do we accommodate that in the building? How do we make the building support the very most empowerment and self-realization of this poor person who's got tuberculosis? And there certainly are things in that building that phenomenally change, alter, significantly benefit the lives of those people that live there in isolation. I mean, look at the same thing in libraries, the same thing in a chapel for a funeral. I mean, all of these things, either you can make the building really support the human values of those people inhabiting it or not. So today we're taking those same issues, but we're looking at it at a scale of neighborhoods, communities, even as large as a city. Are there ways that we can take that same philosophy that asserts the dignity and worth of mankind and manifest that in a larger neighborhood or community or city? And I think this is a big question these days. There are lots of books being written on that because for some reason we have become, in a mobile society, much more concerned about that. In a mobile society, you can choose what neighborhood or community you want to grow up in, what city you want to live in. 100 years ago, if you were born in Beaumont, Texas, you're going to probably freaking stay in Beaumont, Texas till you die. You might go away for a couple of years, but basically, the generally accepted thing was you're going to stay wherever you were put. And it was a kind of major thing to do something like to immigrate somewhere. But now we're extremely mobile society, and there's very good likelihood that you will not live your entire adult life in the place where you grew up. That would be actually these days pretty unusual. So if we're making those choices, we can make choices about what kind of community we want to live in, and how does it fulfill our needs, and how can we have greater self-realization? How can we have greater empowerment? We talked about in a very early lecture the difference between deciding when you graduate that you're going to go live in Lockhart, Texas, on a little tree-lined street in a little bungalow house with a porch out front and a garden in the back, and walk to the grocery store and walk to church and walk to your neighborhood school where your teacher. I mean, that's one kind of life. And then it's a completely different thing if you graduate and then you move to Chelsea in New York and you're living on the fourth floor on a walk-up and, you know, you don't hear the birds in the morning, you hear the dumpster in the morning. And it's a completely anonymous environment. It's wonderful and vital and energized, but you don't know your neighbors and you don't know really anybody in your neighborhood. You're a part of a big, bustling, lively urban metropolis, and you go on the subway and you're jammed up against people, and it's a totally different life, and it's a totally different kind of self-realization that might come from that. So that's really where we're going to troll in a little deeper today. And I'm going to make the argument here at the beginning that there are 8 things that we can do to make communities that embody this notion of humanism at a larger scale. And all through the class, when we're looking at these examples, we'll be going back to those 8 different issues that we might deal with. And I'm going to, as I go through these, talk a little about Austin in particular. It's maybe a myth, but I don't think it's a myth. I think it's somewhat reality. But and I've lived here a really long time, so this is a change. It didn't used to be like this. But now if I go to Vancouver or I go to Milwaukee or, you know, anywhere almost, and I say I'm from Austin, there's a sort of say, oh, man, I hear that's a really great place. I very seldom, you know, the reaction is, man, I hear that sucks. I don't know. There's a perception that Austin is maybe a humane place to live, maybe a place where you can have a kind of empowered, self-fulfilled life. And so what is it that might be contributing to that? What is it that might have changed? Because I don't think necessarily that was the case 25 or 30 years ago. And so I'm going to be talking as we talk through these 8 things, and I'm just defining them. I'm not saying this is 100% the case. I'm just telling you my perceptions about some things that have changed in Austin that seem to me to make it become a more humanistic city. Okay, item number 1 is if you're going to make a place that embodies this notion of humanism, you've got to have convenience. It's got to be a convenient place to live. That means when I need to go get groceries, there's a grocery store nearby. I don't have to get in the car and drive 45 minutes to get a freaking carton of milk. That's horribly inconvenient. A truly humanistic city is going to be convenient. That also means that maybe where I live and where I work are not so far apart, or at least that I don't have to stay on a freaking freeway for hours on end in congestion trying to get from my home to my workplace. It means even that maybe if I'm mobility impaired that, you know, I can get around. There aren't a whole lot of stairs or insurmountable barriers that I can't get where I want to go. Or if I've got a kid and I've got a stroller that I don't like constantly have to, you know, take the kid out, fold the stroller up, you know, hike up the stairs, get the stroller down and put the kid. I mean, that's inconvenient. At every level like that, a humanistic city would be convenient. Now, so how does that apply to Austin over the last 20 years? I mean, I think there was not a lot of options for patterns of living in Austin 25 years ago. If you were fortunate to live in a close-in suburb, you could have a pretty convenient life. But if then you lived anywhere outside those close-in suburbs, there wasn't a choice. You had to deal with traffic and commuting and all that sort of thing. Then just, you know, really it was about 2000. The very first downtown residential buildings began to be built, and there was the possibility that you could actually live in the middle of the city. And that way you could maybe walk to work. You could maybe walk to a grocery store or to a restaurant to have dinner at night. Maybe you could walk to a movie theater instead of having to get in your car and drive a long distance. You could, and you wouldn't have to commute every day, or maybe your commute would be 5 minutes or something like that. So suddenly there was this other pattern of living where you could live in the middle of the city and it could be a whole lot more convenient. That also happened with West Campus, which used to be not very many students lived in West Campus because there just weren't very many places to live in West Campus. And so students lived out on Riverside or they lived in Far West, and there were these little student ghettos out there. Then they changed that, and there began to be a lot more places that you could live in West Campus. And that's a lot more convenient. You can just roll out of bed, and in 10 minutes, you're in class. Instead of having to roll out of bed, walk down 10 minutes to the bus stop, wait for the bus for 15 minutes, get on the bus, have a 10-minute drive to campus, then hop on the bus stop, another 10 minutes to class. I mean, shit, it's a whole lot more convenient, you know, if you can live near where you have to go to class. You can even, after class today, and go home and, you know, have a beer, I don't know, or something before class. No, I didn't say that. But, I mean, there's convenience in being able to live near where you're occupied for other things. So, one thing about a humanistic city and one thing that has changed in Austin is a lot more convenience in the pattern of how housing and businesses and restaurants and recreation and all those things are configured. Okay, a second item is for you to have a humanistic city, there has to be a accommodation of a range of activities. We like stimulus as human beings, and it's nice to have choices about things you can participate in. And sometimes that's informal activity. It's just being able to, you know, go someplace where you can people watch. Just sit down on the West Mall and watch the, you know, good-looking women walk by, or guys. Or it's a, you know, just a place to walk your dog, like, you know, in a park or something like that. Or it's just informal activities. But it also is more formalized activities, like are there music performances? Are there festivals? Are there craft shows? Are there marathons to run or triathlete events? Or, you know, are there things happening? Are there things to do? If it's really going to be a place that empowers people, makes them feel like they can achieve self-realization, there need to be lots of options for, yeah, you can do this, or you could do this, or you could do this, or you could do this. You can do it informally. You can do it in groups. There are orchestrated events. There are things that just happen. But it's a place where things happen. And maybe some of you grew up in a place where things did not happen. And maybe you know a level of kind of boredom and stifling, I don't know. There I am sitting watching TV again tonight and again tomorrow night and again the next night. And this is not the kind of option that really produces a humanistic city. So what has Austin been doing? Oh, holy moly. You can't believe 25 years ago, it was a completely different city in this regard. But now, I mean, you've got South by Southwest, you've got ACL Fest, you've got Fun 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 Fest, you've got Pecan Street Festival, you've got all kinds of fun runs and 15K, and I don't know, I live downtown, so shit. I mean, okay, streets are closed off here because there's X. I mean, even this week, Tuesday, Veterans Day Parade down Congress Avenue on Tuesday, and a week or two ago, it was like 16 streets closed because we're having Fun 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 Fest with F1, and 2 weeks before that, it was ACL Fest for 2 weekends, And you know, okay, it's a little interruption. It's fantastic. There are all those choices. There are things you can do. And it's a very vibrant city to live in because there are so many options. That's a humanistic city, accommodation of a range of activities. Okay, a third thing is there needs to be a range of people accommodated. So it's not so good if you feel like, I'm excluded here. I need to feel like I'm included. There are lots, I can be here and I don't feel like I'm alienated. So that means that if you're an old person or a young person or you're a white person or a black person or you're a extroverted person or you're an introverted person, that there's enough other people kind of like you that you don't feel strange or alienated.
So, a couple of weeks ago, these sorority girls invited me over to their academic banquet, and so I'm the speaker for their academic banquet. That's cool. I could handle that. You know, I go into this big dining room. It's a freaking big sorority house, and it's like 150 women and me. Now, I don't think of myself as feeling alienated normally, but I'll tell you, if you get that much estrogen in the room, and I'm like the only testosterone, it feels awkward. It just feels like, I don't know, do I belong here? And that's what happens in monocultures, where there's not a range of people. There's only one kind of person there. And then if you're not that kind of person, you feel a little weird. Truly humanistic environments welcome all kinds of people so that you don't feel alienated. You feel like you belong no matter what your inclinations are. And I think that's a really important quality of a humanistic environment. And there again, Austin's not 100% great about this, but there are a little few things that have been improved on that. So, for instance, I really like my particular neighborhood downtown. There are like 14 restaurants within two blocks of where I live. And there's everything from the Hofbräu, where my parents went to the Hofbräu to eat when they were students at UT in the 1940s. I mean, it's been there forever, and it hasn't changed a bit. It's still got the lousiest quality meat in the city. The chewiest steaks you'll ever find, and still got the same freaking salad with way too much oil in the salad dressing and not enough vinegar. And it's just, it's just this old kind of creepy, been there forever, traditional restaurant. And it's cheap. Ooh, super cheap. So I love the fact it's still there. It's still there amidst all these sort of chic, foodie, cool places to eat. Hut's Hamburgers, which has been there, again, 40 or 50 years, it's got burgers, just all kinds of burgers, damn good burgers, too. Or Frank and Angie's Pizza. Just really, really great pizza. But then also, there's like, La Condesa, and La Corazon, and all these fancy pants, there's Morton Steakhouse and Ruth Chris Steakhouse, places you'd only go if your dad's footing the bill for dinner. It's a range of people accommodated so that you've got a little bit of money. Yeah, you can handle it there. You got a lot of money? Cool. You can do that too. That's an environment that has a range of people accommodated. Okay, so a fourth thing. A humanistic city has a sense of human presence. There is the idea that this is for people. You're being addressed. Somebody's talking to you. You get a sense of somebody else's footprints have been here, and they left a message that they convey over a longer period of time. So, for example, historic buildings are kind of a sense of human presence that you see, 100 years ago, somebody was here, right in this spot. They lived in that house. Or 150 years ago, they built that freaking Capitol building. Man, somebody put a ton of energy and vitality and effort, and they left it, and that's a sign of human presence. So it's historic things like that. It may be, craft like stone carving or wood carving on a building. That's a sign of somebody's investment of time and energy in doing that. It may be even just a well-tended flower box. Somebody planted those posies and weeded it and watered it and cared for it and so that I could enjoy it. It's meant for your visual pleasure. And it can even be things that aren't necessarily even beautiful, like maybe it's, placards that tell you there's going to be a concert tonight or, vote for so-and-so. These are communication, signs of human presence. So anything like that in the environment, if it's sterile and there aren't those kinds of things, then it is not a truly humanistic city. But those kinds of things are important to making it more humanistic. So in downtown Austin, that's
partly why. I mean, we hang on to things like the Bremont Block. We looked at two of those houses in the Bremont Block down at Guadalupe and 7th Street. A couple of lectures ago when we were talking about climate. Beautiful old 19th century houses that are right in the middle of downtown. High dollar real estate, but absolutely incredibly important to keep those signs of human presence. That house that was built 150 years ago, that detail and stone carving and, you know, beautifully tended lawn. I mean, these are important as a part of a humanistic environment. So, yeah, that's an important factor too, signs of human presence. Fifth factor is personal or human scale. And this means that there needs to be something that's kind of our size as a human being. If it's too large, it's kind of thwarting or oppressive. And this is a problem with a lot of downtown modern environments, that maybe the buildings are all too big. And yeah, you get the sense of corporate greatness here, but wait a minute, what about me as an individual human being? So it's important to have, maybe the grand scale is great. Yeah, that feels like, yeah, I'm part of a larger, bigger community, but also it needs to scale down to the point of, okay, what about me, my size, my body, my hands, you know, that size. And that's another thing that often older buildings can do. They give that scale that was maybe the scale of the city in a previous era. But I think new buildings often can do that too. There's actually an ordinance on Congress Avenue downtown that says that you go up 4 or 5 floors and then you step back from the street. So that if you're going to build a 40-story tower, you're not going to build it right up against the sidewalk. You have to have something that's a more human scale, more 4 or 5 floors, and then you can step back and have your tall building. Now, there are a few buildings built before that ordinance was put in, and they were done, and people looked at them and said, well, that's not very humanistic. It's a little oppressive having this thing go right straight up. I'd rather there be something my scale. And so that ordinance was put in on Congress Avenue to make it a more pedestrian-friendly, humanistic environment. So personal or human scale. The sixth thing is a variety of visual experience concurrent with some harmony. A variety of visual experience concurrent with some harmony. So this is a fine line to walk. You know, you don't want it looking so uniform that it looks like you're in an army barracks here. Everything the same, 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 same. That's boring and it's oppressive. And yet on the same, by the same token, you don't want chaos. You don't want everything in the book slammed at you all at once. That just seems confusing. But there is a way to get a variety of visual experience so that there is some range there. But also it feels harmonious. It feels like these buildings are neighborly with each other. They're paying attention to each other. They're becoming a larger ensemble. And I think the campus does a really good job of that at UT. Mostly, occasionally there's a building that sort of sticks out like a sore thumb. But many of them, they're different from each other. Maybe some of them built a century later than some other ones. And so technologies are different, lifestyles are different. Yeah, they should be different. But there still is a little conversation. There's some harmony that ties them together. So a variety of visual experience concurrent with some harmony. The seventh item is a freedom from intrusion or distraction. A freedom from intrusion or distraction. Basically, that means, you know, if I'm constantly having to deal with the traffic, like I'm walking down the street, I'm having a nice conversation with my friend, we hit a street, and then there's a huge, big old bus, and it's roaring, and it's belching out the black smoke, and then there's bicycles coming in every direction, and it's like a hazard to get across the street. Well, that's not a very pleasant environment as a pedestrian. It's distracting to have all of those things slammed at you all the time. Now, obviously, those things have to coexist in the city, but there are ways to manage those so that they're not so distracting. Often, traffic is a distraction. The noise of it, the danger of it, the smell of it.
sometimes that's a distraction. Can you find a way to make the people compatible with the cars so that they're not too distracting? Another distraction often is maybe the weather. It's like blazing freaking hot here, you know, tons and tons of sun. If I'm trying to go from point A to point B, and it's just so sunny that it's August and I'm sweating and I'm uncomfortable, that's very distracting. If there are nice shade trees that I can walk under and I get a little breeze, that's much better. If there's even an arcade that I can walk under in the shade, protected from the rain or protected from the sun. These are ways that the distraction of climate can be mitigated and give you more freedom from intrusion or distraction. And then the eighth and final thing is periodic natural relief. Periodic natural relief. And this is, I think, somehow just a basic human need. We need to see things that are green. And it makes us feel refreshed. So in any kind of community or neighborhood or urban environment, it's important to think of green stuff. And that's actually even, you need that photosynthesis, it makes the air healthier, all kinds of things like that. But in addition, there's just a kind of psychological boost that comes from that. And that's another thing that Austin's really fantastic about, it, actually. The center of the city, for one thing, there's a lake going through the whole center, and there's parkland all along the lake and tons of trees and water and birds and snakes and possums and all kinds of critters in there. Lots and lots more and more these days of street trees and vegetation that is in the part of, in the urban part of the city. And then there are oases like this big park around the Capitol building and lots of park-like areas through the campus. And there are these creeks that go through Shoal Creek and Waller Creek. And there are almost sometimes even wilderness kind of creek space that goes through the city. All of those tend to make Austin more interesting and more vital because of the periodic natural relief. Okay, so I'm arguing that the chemistry of all of those little bits and pieces make a humanistic city. And if you don't have those qualities, then you get some of these cities that are actually not very desirable for people to live in. And there's a really great book came out several years ago called The Rise of the Creative Class by a guy named Richard Florida. And he makes the argument in that book that the most important economic driver for cities these days is attracting good labor force. You're going to get good business and good economics if you have a good labor force. And these days, because people are mobile, they choose where they want to live. So if you have a cool-ass place to live that people enjoy, then you're going to have a good workforce, and they're going to get all the big companies and the good jobs, and they're going to come there. And likewise, if it's kind of a sucky place to live, and it's boring, and it's stupid, and it's ugly, then people will not want to live there, and you will not get the prize workforce, and you will not get the good companies, and you'll have a crappy economy. And that's kind of the story of places like, Cleveland and Pittsburgh. And they've kind of fallen off the economic chart because people didn't feel like they were great places to live. And then places like San Francisco or Austin, they kind of came up on the chart. And their economies have grown because they're deemed to be a place that's cool and humanistic to live. Interesting observation, so that this is more than just an argument about, yes, wouldn't this be nice? This is an economic argument that makes the difference between whether a city is thriving or whether it's greatly diminished. Okay, so let's look at some examples and see what I'm talking about here. So we're going to look at the beginning here at three communities, one of them a community of about 800 people, in a residential neighborhood associated with a university in California. And then we're going to look at a neighborhood of about 10,000 people in a city in England. And then we're going to look at a whole kind of town of about 50,000 people in Finland. And they're going to roll back and kind of see, okay, what does that mean in terms of our own neighborhoods and communities in the United States? So this is Kresge College at the University of Santa Cruz. The architect is Charles Moore. You guys are reading The Place of Houses, the author of that. One of the authors is Charles Moore. The first three chapters of that book, one is on Edgartown, one is on Santa Barbara, one is on Sea Ranch. It's all about communities. How do you engender a sense of place, a sense of identity, a sense of well-being? How do you make a community that's a desirable place to live in Edgartown or in Santa Barbara or in Sea Ranch? So they're talking about a lot of the same things we're talking about in this lecture today. And Charles Moore, who wrote that book, is also the guy who designed this environment. So we can kind of see, is he putting his money where his mouth is here? And actually, there are references to Kresge College in the book as well. You should realize by now that if there's an overlap between what we're talking about in class and what's in the book, it's probably a really good opportunity for a quiz question. So that intersection between The Place of Houses and this lecture is pretty fertile ground. Okay, so Kresge College. So this was an interesting time in California. In the late 1960s, there had been this huge rebellion of Berkeley College students against the dormitories at Berkeley. In the 50s and 60s, they had built all of these big shoebox dormitories, just really, really dumb, stupid, cheap housing. And they just literally were a shoebox with a bunch of windows in it, and they were identical, and they built about 12 of them all around the campus. And they just shoved lots of college students in there. I mean, it was just efficient, right? We're just going to have lots of cheap housing for these college students. Double-loaded corridor, gang bathroom, identical rooms. And in the late 60s, the students at Berkeley just rebelled against that. And for one thing, they moved out. So there were huge vacancies in this student housing. That's pretty rare on a college campus where, you know, usually, students want to live on campus. Well, no, they didn't want to live in these things on campus. So they moved out. They got graffiti painted all over them. There was just real rebellion against these dormitories. So here we are at University of Santa Cruz. It's a brand new university. They're establishing it in the early 1970s. It's the same system as Berkeley, and they're scratching their head and thinking, wait, if we build the wrong kind of dormitory, we're going to get the same kind of rebellion. So we got to pay attention to what the students want here, and we got to make something that's going to be an environment they really enjoy living in. So they took a completely different attitude than they had in the 50s when they built the shoeboxes. And Charles Moore went into the community there, and this university had just been started. And he met with the students and said, well, how would you like to live, and what would you like to do, and what kind of, environment would be best for you? And Santa Cruz had attracted a particular kind of student, still attracts that kind of student. They're basically, eternal hippies at University of Santa Cruz, and lots of flowers in their hair, and I don't know, but a real liberal artsy college, and a cool but different kind of student. And so they described to Charles Moore, well, we want this really interactive environment, and we want a really social environment, and we want it really low-key and comfortable. It doesn't have to be pretentious or fancy or anything like that. So he took very seriously all of this input from the students. And they built Kresge College, which was, in fact, very, very inexpensive. It was built on the same kind of budget as those shoebox dorms at Berkeley. But it was made in a much more humane way. So the campus is in the middle of this redwood forest. Gorgeous, gorgeous redwood forest. The whole campus sits on the Pacific Ocean, too. Couldn't find a more beautiful site. So the one thing the students said was, man, we love the forest. We love the redwoods. So basically, they spotted all the redwoods all the way through the environment, and they wiggled the buildings around the wet redwood trees so that they ended up making this little street like this that wiggles around through the forest. At one end of it is all the food, the cafeteria and dining hall and cafes and things like that. At the other end is the kind of academic anchor. That's where their classes are. And it was a kind of novel arrangement here. You don't have all the dormitories over here and all the academic buildings over there. It was mixed use. So basically the academic part of the campus is in this larger college or residential environment with a dining hall and with some classrooms and things that happened here. So there's a little library and there are administrative offices and there are faculty offices and they're all kind of distributed in this college for 800 students. And the idea of the anchors being on either end is that your normal day, you live in the dormitories, which are the blue buildings, you go to classes in the red buildings, you eat in the black building, or you maybe go visit a faculty member or go to the library in a black building, and you're constantly interacting back and forth between these things. And that environment is this environment full of trees, and the buildings are inexpensive, but they're lively, interesting buildings. On the right, we're seeing that dining area at one end of the campus. On the left, we're seeing the more academic core at the other end of the campus. And then in between are all of the residential buildings, the dormitories for all the students. So very convenient environment. It's not very far down to the dining halls, not very far down to your classes. A real sense of community. You see the same people over and over that are going back and forth on this pathway. Great weather in Santa Cruz, kind of perfect weather there. So the outdoor environment is really great. Never too cold, never too hot. And the idea is it's just a really great social, easygoing, laid-back campus environment. And this building, I have a cousin that lives in Santa Cruz, so I go back there periodically, and I probably visited this thing five or six times. I visited right after it was finished in the 1970s. And, you know, it's just had great longevity. Nothing's changed. Everything's pretty much just the same it was designed. And it just seems to be really, really weathering life in it extremely well, even though built extremely cheaply. Okay, so how does it do these eight things? Tons and tons of signs of human presence. There are kind of intentional things, like that's actually the old laundromat. And on either side, this lets you know it was built in the 70s, but there was a phone booth on either side. So when you go in and wash your clothes, you'd come out and get on the phone, talk to your girlfriend. There's a little steps there so that they can have a music performance or a rally or something like that. So this is kind of the main square of the village and right by where people are hanging out and doing their laundry and talking on the telephone and doing other kinds of things. And then you see this kind of rainbow, a little bit of artwork that goes in there and gives that signs of human presence. The steps, the phone booths, the laundromat, the rainbow, it's all, you know, saying there's somebody here and there's action here. The same thing goes for these little stoops that take you up to your individual apartment, and even things like the bicycles and motorcycles and stuff sitting out there. It's occupied. And you definitely get that feel at Kresge. It's occupied. People have balconies. And, you know, like I said, it doesn't have to be gorgeous. I was there around Thanksgiving this time. We get jack-o'-lanterns. We got there, you know, just cheap little director's chairs. This lovely little end table, cardboard box. But, you know, it's inhabited. You get a sense of there are people hanging out here and enjoying it. Another piece of artwork, a little super graphics up there. These are important things for making the place seem like it's inhabited, signs of human presence. It's also a really great scale here. Some of the buildings are pretty big. Some of them are really, you want them to feel big. That's an important entry to some important building there, and so it's got kind of a big scale. And then other times it's got kind of an intimate scale. I'm wandering off going into the woods here, and it's got a kind of gateway, and it scales down to my size. So very careful delineation of scale in the buildings. Great handling of freedom from intrusion or distraction. All the cars are outside. This is that little gateway into the whole place. So you go out there and there's the roadway and there's the parking lot and all the cars. But then you then become a pedestrian and you walk around and the entire village is pedestrian oriented. No cars there at all. So you don't have to worry about buses or cars or anything like that. You can catch them to go to some other area on the campus or around or go into the city. But basically within this little enclave, there are no cars. And often there are there's good shade, and there's little arcades in part of it that keep the rain off and things like that. Okay, freedom from intrusion and distraction. Another thing that's fantastic here is the periodic natural relief. So you've always got those big redwoods, and you know, you have the little street going along there, and you have the buildings on either side of the street. Well, on the back side of those buildings, where they're in the redwood forest, they're not white anymore. Then they turn the color of the forest. So on the people side, it's white. On the nature side, it's brown. And it really emphasizes that, okay, we're deferring to the natural relief here, that it really becomes the forest on one side of it. And you just go through a gateway, and you're in a deep kind of primeval forest. Really, really beautiful. So the argument I'm making here, and you know, just imagine yourself in this place. It's just a friendly, amenable, considerate, convenient, active, stimulating kind of environment. And people love living in Kresge College, and they have for generations of college students. It's very important to incorporate these values to make an environment like that. Okay. Second example. I told you we're going to go up in scale here. So this one is a community for 10,000 people in Newcastle upon Tyne, which is a northern England industrial city. And actually, Newcastle upon Tyne is not a nice city. It's super industrial and kind of gritty, kind of cold city. But it's got its moments. It's got a river that runs through it. But basically, it's kind of a hard, cold, and they got a cold climate. It's not on anybody's tourist destination. It ain't London. So we're in Newcastle upon Tyne. We've got a very big neighborhood of 10,000 people, and that's what it looked like in the slide on the left. It was all these workers' housing that had been built in the 17th century that did not have indoor plumbing originally. So they were just really rudimentary little row houses, just a brick wall on both sides, brick wall on both ends, a few little windows in the end walls. It would have just been a living room, dining room, kitchen on the bottom floor, a couple of bedrooms on the top floor, tiny little units, and no plumbing initially. Then in the 20th century, they would have come along, and because the only place they could add the plumbing was on the ends of the buildings, so they would put a bathroom on the end of the building, so that blocked all the windows. So now you get no light into your living room or your bedroom, but now you do have a bathroom, and that occupied the entire, what might have been a backyard. So these were wretched, you know, a little bit charming to look at all those brick buildings, but honestly, horrible places to live. So in the 1960s, the British government came in and said, okay, this was all owned by the government. It was worker housing, public housing owned by the government. So we're getting lots of complaints. They decided, okay, we're going to come in and completely redo the entire neighborhood. We're going to move everybody out. We're going to tear down all those wretched old buildings. And it was just blocks and blocks and blocks like that. Tear them all out, build all new housing, move the people back in, and everybody will be much better off. So they go out looking for an architect, and they identify this guy named Ralph Erskine. And Erskine was a Brit, but he had, in World War II, he had left Britain because he was anti-war. And when Britain declared war, he was a peacenik. So he moved to Sweden. Sweden was neutral in World War II. So then after the war, he just stayed in Sweden. And he's an idiosyncratic, crazy kind of guy. So he's an architect, and he's working in Sweden. You know where his office is? So he works in Stockholm. Stockholm's a coastal city. It's in an archipelago. So he decides, okay, I'm going to have my office on a boat. I love boats. So he gets himself this big boat, and his office is on a boat. And so then in the summertime, he'll just take the boat off, and for 2 weeks, they'll go down the coast, and they'll stop at all the little villages, and they're working at their drafting boards all day long, and you know, get off and walk in a new little village, and then the next day, they're in another little village, and the whole team, the whole office, kind of moves around on this boat in the summertime. So this is not a this is not a buttoned-up kind of guy. He's a pretty loose guy. And this, one of the specialties of his practice is low-income housing. He likes to build places for poor people. Really, really good, solid, welcoming kinds of places for poor people, but built rather cheaply. So these people in Newcastle say, I think he's our man. He knows a lot about low-income housing. He's an expert on this. He's got a lot of positive reputation for that. So they bring him down to Newcastle, and they say, okay, this is our piece of land. We're going to tear down all these buildings. You're going to build 10,000 units of housing. And he says, no way. No way. Not interested at all. And I said, dude, this is like your specialty. This is like a great commission for you. Why wouldn't you want to do this? And he said, well, look, if you take all those people, and for one thing, where the hell are you going to move them? They're going to get uprooted from their community. These people have got multi-generational families here. So I live here. Aunt Matilda lives across the street. Grandma and Grandpa live down the street. Uncle Fred lives, down the other street. I mean, they've got all these ties in the community. And you're just going to disrupt all that, move them out somewhere. And then for two or three years, you're going to tear down everything. Two or three years later, you build it all up. By then, they've already got their kids in school out there, or they've already, going to a church over here. And then they're not going to move back. And then you get a whole bunch of new people in there. They don't know each other. They're all, there are no ties. There are no roots. There's no fabric, social fabric. This is not going to make a successful environment. People are going to feel very alienated here. I don't want to have anything to do with that. So he goes back to Sweden. And they think about it a little while. And finally they call him back and they say, well, you're right. We don't want to do that, but how do we solve that problem? Because we got this wretched housing. We need new housing. How are we going to solve the problem? And he said, well, the thing to do is to take one of these little rows of houses right here. And you take the one that has the most vacancies in it, because a lot of them were boarded up and just condemned. So you find the one with the most vacancies, and you take the rest of the people out and move them into vacant properties across the street. And then you tear down that one block. And then you talk to all these people that are living in this block, and you ask them what they would like to have, and they're the client, and you tell them, we're going to be building you houses right here, and you're just going to move across the street. And then when you finish it, they move across the street. Then you tear down that block. And you ask the people on the next block, what do you want? And so by domino effect, you slowly redo the entire community. And at the same time, you leave all the churches, you leave all the social clubs, you leave all the schools, so that people are still invested in those things in their community. And it'll take 15 years to do this. You won't do it overnight. But in 15 years, you'll have a well-established community of people who have social roots and who have friends and family, and they're all together and it's a real community. But now it's all in newer buildings. So they bought that, and they said, okay, we want you to do it and do it that way. So he moves his office down to Newcastle upon Tyne. He wasn't going to do it in Stockholm and send the drawings. He wanted to be in the community. So he found an abandoned funeral parlor, and they converted the funeral parlor into an architect's office. And it had glass on the front of it. And whenever they finished their drawings one day, they'd just pin up the drawings. And then they'd ask people to come by and comment. And so people, anybody could just come by and say, I don't really like the way that's working. Couldn't the bathroom be over here? And they had lots and lots of meetings and community forums and town halls and things like that. And got a lot of input from the people in the community as to what they wanted. And over a period of 15 years, they completely rebuilt the area. Now, that actually made the people in Biker, which is what this neighborhood was called, but these people had a completely different attitude about what architects do. That whole moving in the community, having all these meetings, talking with people, this very sensitive way of redeveloping, it made them think of architects a different way. So I'm visiting this place maybe two-thirds of the way through the process, and it's a freezing cold December day, and I've got my camera around my neck, and I'm you know, taking pictures and walking around, and then it's so freezing cold. Sometimes I just like duck in a lobby or something just to warm up. So I duck in a little lobby, and I'm warming up for a little while there. And this little old lady comes in. She's about 3 feet tall, little gnome Brit lady. And she's got her purse and her, you know, she's been out shopping. And so she comes in and she presses the elevator to go up. And she's eyeing me really funny. She's looking at me like, who are you? Do you belong here? So I don't want to, you know, I want to reassure her I'm okay. I'm not dangerous. So I walk over and say, you know, I'm an architect from the United States. I'm just interested in, you know, the redevelopment going on in this community. And so I'm just warming up because it's cold outside. And she said, oh, you're an architect. Oh, good. You know, I pressed the button for this elevator, and it's not coming. Could you fix that? I'm like, well, dude, I'm an architect. I'm not an elevator repairman. But I thought, okay, well, let's see. So I push the button. I kind of kick the door a little bit, and the elevator comes. And this woman is just like, okay, that's what architects do. They help you out. They make the building work for you. And literally, the architects, when somebody had a washer went out in their sink and the faucet was dripping, and they call the architects and say, my faucet is dripping in my sink. And the architects would say, well, let me come over and see if I can put a washer in. Instead of saying, that's not my job, you know, call a plumber. But they took responsibility for that neighborhood. And the people there just thought of, yeah, these architects, they're thinking of my whole life, my whole building. Okay, so how did it incorporate some of these things we've been talking about? Incredible, incredible respect for signs of human presence and just taking care of what was already there. So there was this bathhouse, this old bathhouse right there, and they just incorporated it into the rest of the buildings. The buildings build this kind of what they call the biker wall, but a long continuous row of buildings. Sometimes it's old buildings, sometimes it's new buildings, but they could just weave the history of the neighborhood into the new buildings that are there. Another kind of sign of human presence. You walk down the corridor here, and this is just the corridor. It's giving, you know, access to all the apartments. But along here, there's a little flower box here. I'm here in freaking December, and they still got some kind of green vine that's growing there. And I'm sure in the summertime that would have some, you know, nice geraniums or something. But there's something where the person living here can have a little bit of expression on the outside, and people walking by can enjoy the expression of somebody inside. That's a great sign of human presence. Also, these little benches. So actually, when I took this picture, there was not the same little old lady, a different little old lady was sitting on this bench right here. And it's freaking cold outside, but she's just sitting there in her coat, and she's just waiting for neighbors to pass by because she lives by herself, so she just enjoys it. If somebody passes by, says hello to her, maybe has a little conversation, maybe she sees her friend walk by and they go inside and have tea. But she likes to just sit on her little bench. Every single unit has a little bench. So that allows her to be out there. But even if she's not there, the bench is there as a sign of human presence. I actually asked, could I take your picture here, you know, on your bench? And she said, oh, no, no. Oh, no, my hair. It's awful. No, you can't take my picture. So I didn't get a picture of her. But there still is the bench, which is a sign of her presence. But also that bench is there for convenience, too. So she's explaining to me that when I come home with my bag of groceries, and I got my purse, and I got my bag of groceries, and I'm coming up, and I need to get my keys. And so she said, I just set the groceries on that bench. I get my keys out of my purse. I open the door. I take the groceries off the bench, and I go in. How thoughtful that there's a place for my groceries right there. I don't have to bend down and put them on the floor. It's a sign of human presence, that accommodation, that convenience that's there. And this is all over the freaking building. Super convenience in terms of just planning where things go. So the little corner grocery stores, no more than 5 minutes from your house. So you can walk 5 minutes in any direction, and there's going to be a little corner grocery store. There's always going to be a play yard for any of the areas that have, like, housing that has kids, like a 2 or 3 bedroom unit. There's going to be a play yard right by it. And then right by the play yard, there's going to be a chess board. And that's where the old guys sit and play chess, and they can watch the little kids. Entertains them a little bit to watch little kids. But also, mom can go back inside and say, look, Uncle George, would you keep an eye out for little Johnny while I go in? Oh, yeah, I'll do that. So he's playing chess. The kid's playing over here. Mom's back inside. Super convenient. And all that kind of intergenerational activity is just set up by the environment. Wide range of people accommodated. There are lots of places for families in this particular building. That's a townhouse. It's probably 3 bedrooms. It's got living room, dining room, kitchen, bedrooms up above. That's for a family, and they've got a little yard out here. So that's family dwelling. Up here, that's a corridor that you go into a living room and go upstairs to the bedrooms, or you go into a living room and go downstairs to the bedrooms. There's no elevator stop at this floor, only on this floor. That means that everybody shares a corridor. 3 times as many people share that corridor. So you're likely to run into more people that way than if there was a corridor here and another corridor here and another corridor here. So you walk along here, you go in your living room. That's where all those planter boxes and the benches are. And those are for more not families. That's where, like, that little old lady lives by herself in one of those little flats. Or maybe that's a couple with no kids. Or maybe that's 2 gay guys or something. But that's for one kind of demographic. This is another kind of demographic, but they all share the elevator and the public spaces and all those things around the building. So just intrinsically in the building, you've got a variety of people accommodated. You also have this variety of visual expression, but also some harmony. So it's kind of all done by one architect. It could have been really boring, but in fact, they make a real effort to make visual differences. Sometimes it's really, really all out of brick, and sometimes it's much more out of wood. Sometimes it's tall and white, and sometimes it's kind of dark, and sometimes it's got big windows, and sometimes it's got small windows. But there is something that makes the whole village hang together as well. Incredible freedom from intrusion and distraction. This is a pretty big part of the city, and they can bring in sometimes service vehicles like fire trucks or emergency vehicles, but for most of the time, that's just a pedestrian way, and then a ramp that goes up to a big green up here. But so it's mostly not cars on the interior part of the village. And then always these covered areas where you're going from one place to another, getting out of that rain, which is pretty common in England. More freedom from intrusion and distraction. The roadways out here, that biker wall is up against a kind of freeway. So on this side, only the windows are 2 bathrooms or kitchens, and all their living room and bedroom windows are on the other side, looking south and down to the river. So they kind of turn their back on the noise of the freeway and turn their front and all their orientation to the south and to the view of the river. Again, that kind of passageway for delivery trucks and things like that, but basically a pedestrian environment where it's perfectly safe for the kids to go out and play in the playground right there. And tons of periodic natural relief. The old biker had not a twig on it. The new biker has lawns, has gardens. This is, again, in December, but they've got roses blooming here. These people, the Brits, love their gardens, and so for a lot of the units, there's actually a little, tiny little garden attached to your unit so that you can grow your vegetation and periodic natural relief for everybody else to enjoy. So here it is, huge environment. What a mammoth effort. Low-income housing, super cheap. But out of that, they make this healthy, amenable, good environment for the people who live there. Okay, busting up one more scale. This is a whole town that was built outside of Helsinki in Finland. So as Helsinki began to grow as a city, instead of just having suburban sprawl, they decided, no, we're going to build a new town outside the city. and it's going to be a self-contained town. So you don't have to commute back into Helsinki. So this one is called Tapiola, and it has a town center here where there's offices and businesses and industry and those kinds of things. And then there are lots of little neighborhoods. Each of these circles is a neighborhood. And that's a 10-minute walk across that circle. And inside that circle, there would always be a little neighborhood, grocery store, dry cleaner, elementary school, those kinds of things that one could always walk to within the circle. And then between the circles, there are passageways. And again, it's totally separating pedestrian from cars, so that there are ways, pedestrian routes, that can take you from anywhere in Tapiola down to the city center by foot. And it might be 15 or 20 minute walk from any of those outside areas, but you could walk there, or you know, you can drive there as well. But within this little 5 minute walk, you can have everything that you need for your immediate life. And it's in this beautiful part of Finland where there's that archipelago out there, lots of little islands, beautiful trees, tons of water, gorgeous views. So it was a great environment to place the town to begin with. And again, a wide variety of people accommodated. There's single family houses that have kind of rich people and lots of land and one story and kind of luxurious. And then there's sort of middle income housing, maybe in apartments or something like that. Then there's high-rise housing over here, accommodation of all different kinds of family types and demographics. Incredibly convenient community. They've thought of everything, not just, you know, those things I was talking about of 5-minute walk and 15-minute walk, but there also are great, great recreational activities. There are swimming pools, there are gyms, there are concert halls, there are outdoor amphitheaters. There's just all kinds of things built into parks and hike and bike trails that wind through the entire city. Every little neighborhood has a neighborhood center like this that would have the grocery store, and it would have you know, a dry cleaner, and it would have maybe a dentist's office or a doctor's office up there. But all the kinds of things you'd need for your neighborhood would be in a little town, little community center there. There are tons of recreation facilities. This one's a huge playground area for kids. I was there in the summertime. I have never seen more joggers in my life. These Finns are super fit. And they're all out there running and got their strollers and they're, you know, going to play racquetball and lift weights. And I mean, they've got all these gyms and they're just, there's a lot of fitness and all connected together through this parkway and hike and bike system. A lot of variety of visual experience. There are many, many architects that worked in this area, and sometimes they're fresh, clean, modern stuff, and sometimes it's kind of funky, softer kind of stuff, but different scales and different visual expressions throughout. And of course, just periodic natural relief everywhere. It's like a garden town. It's full of green. So again, you can scale it up. It can be any particular size. Now, I said earlier, there's this big economic argument here, and maybe the best expression of that is to look down to San Antonio, where the very biggest industry in San Antonio is tourism. The very biggest tourist attraction is the San Antonio Riverwalk. The Riverwalk is an urban environment that incorporates these eight things we've just been talking about. It was actually initiated by a guy named H.H. Hugman. He was a 20-something guy when he had the idea for this. He was a graduate of School of Architecture at UT, moved back down to San Antonio, and he said, you know, this flood-prone river here, and now they're thinking of filling it in. What if we had this kind of level below the city where there were lots of restaurants and there were bars and there were parks and it was this kind of oasis down below the level of the street. And so instead of filling in that river, which had had a big flood, instead they started the San Antonio Riverwalk. And now there have been, the initial sort of whole thing was done in the 1920s and 30s. There was a resuscitation again in the 60s. Now the thing goes way up north, past the Pearl Brewery, way down south. There's wetlands, there's hike and bike trails. I mean, it's an entire big system of recreation and amenity spaces in the city. And it is a big economic driver in downtown San Antonio. What they did was, that's the San Antonio River, they just connected it here, because when a flood came and it tried to do that, it flooded the whole city. So they connected it there, and then that became the Riverwalk. And it got those shops and tons of activities that go on there. There's an amphitheater, so you can have performances. There are lots of restaurants, and they have Fiesta down there. There are lots of special orchestrated activities. Great variety of visual experience. Great signs of human presence. Little bits of history of the whole area are explained there. Lots and lots of little umbrellas and, you know, just things that let you know there's action happening here. And then incredible periodic natural relief. Again, a kind of garden down there. They planted tons of cypress trees, lots of exotic tropical trees that couldn't really survive up on the top, but because there's a more moderate, temperate microclimate down below on this lower level of the city, they could have more exotic plants that could be down there. And this huge economic engine that has made a big, big difference in the city of San Antonio. A more recent example, Chicago, I don't know, 8 or 10 years ago, decided that they were going to take an old railroad yard and convert it into Millennium Park. And this was a huge investment. They got primarily private money to do it. There's some city money in it. It's got a huge outdoor performance space designed by Frank Gehry that we're seeing there. There's gardens in it. There are plazas. It's just a wonderful place to hang out in downtown San Antonio, in downtown Chicago. And it's people of all ages, little kids from the neighborhoods around, businessmen from the office buildings around. It's just a great place where everybody comes together on a Saturday afternoon. It's just a gas to watch the people there. This one particular area, which is called Crown Fountain, has an artwork that is these two pylons on either end, and they have faces of Chicago people projected on the face of the pylon, just ordinary Chicago people. And they, their faces slowly move, so like they're blinking their eyes or they're licking their lips, but there's huge, huge faces looming up there. And then sometimes when they purse their lips, they spit. And the water comes out like that. And then all these little kids that are playing down at the bottom, they know just when that's going to happen, and they line up and all of them go through and get themselves completely drenched. And then they all line up along the back here. And then they know that right after she stops spitting, then there's going to be this huge waterfall that goes down and drenches them all at the bottom. And it's just this little bit of theater, bit of urban theater that is created by this artwork. And really, all those things we've been talking about, these signs of human presence, you have these big faces and, you know, periodic natural relief, the gardens that are there, lots of activities going on, variety of people accommodated. That's what makes Millennium Park so great. Okay, Twitter card question for today. So last time we talked about humanism, this time we talked about humanism. Several Twitter card questions back, I asked you on issues of climate. In 10 years, if you're building a house, how important would climate be in terms of what house you selected? Today, I'm asking you, project 10 years from now. How important will notions of humanism be in you making a choice of where you want to live? How important will notions of humanism be in you selecting where you want to live? Is it going to be absolutely, this is the most important thing for me to think about? I want to live in a place that really has all this vibrancy we're talking about. Or you could say, you know, it's kind of important. Among other things, it's something I'll think about. Or maybe the other possibility is, I don't really care. I'm going to go somewhere where I get a good job that pays a badass salary, and I'll survive. It doesn't matter where I live.